You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Good afternoon. Unusual taping schedule. Thank you for accommodating me today, Bill.
No problem. Matt is gallivanting around the country, a speaker in demand, as the Republican Party continues its descent into oblivion. People want to know how fast will the party fall, and so that means Matt Lewis is an on-demand speaker on the circuit.
Well, that's not how the pitches necessarily go, but
that's not what's in your promotional materials.
Well, I had to, when I started, I was in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee last night, and I had to start my speech by citing that Woody Allen line, I don't have anything positive to say when you settle for two negatives, because it was nothing but gloom and doom, you know, nothing but bad news. Somehow I got them to laugh a few times, but it's not the easiest, it's not the most light, fun, lighthearted topic right now.
So, but you are talking to a room. This is a speech you gave in Milwaukee this week. So this was a room of conservatives.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, which is a free market think tank. So this was my crowd. So this was
So when people are walking in, is everyone just hanging their head, looking at their feet, mumbling to themselves? Is it just gallows humor the whole time, or is there any kind of camaraderie that at least we're all in a room together and we can be together while the world burns around us?
I think everybody tries to put their best face on, but the sort of the subtext is not great. I mean, I'm sure there were a certain percentage of people there who are somewhat enthusiastically supporting Trump, but a lot of conservatives, you know, in general, are kind of resigned to losing in less than 2 weeks, and now just hoping to hold on to the Senate. So it's weird, man. It's sort of like I flew through O'Hare, and there was a guy like basically wearing a Chicago Cubs uniform like at the airport, you know. So you can see how people who are winning get there's a certain feeling of excitement that happens when you feel like you're winning, and then there's a certain feeling when you feel like you're losing. And I think that conservatives right now, certainly are, we've had better days. Let's just leave it like that. But when you're gathering, you're talking about ideas, it's always fellowship and camaraderie are fun, despite the gloomy times.
Now, if I was an intellectual conservative like you, Matt Lewis, and like the people you were speaking with, I mean, I think I would be rooting for a collapse, because you want the Trump wing to be fully humiliated and destroyed, have no thin reed to cling to say, well, we're the future here, and we have this momentum, and it was just rigged by the media, and if we stick together, then we'll build that wall. That wall will be ours. If they have enough of a toehold in the party, that makes your job a lot tougher. If they just get wiped, you're in a better position to say, okay, we need to rebuild out of the ashes here, and the Trump way is clearly the way to permanent defeat.
Yeah, except that, I think that's true. I think if Trump loses by a landslide, it could delegitimize Trumpism, and the public, not the public, but the base could even turn on him. A certain percentage, some people are going to be with Trump no matter what, but there'll be other people who are like, they'll abandon him like they abandon other nominees who've lost. People like a winner and will not tolerate a loser, to paraphrase Patton. But if it's close, Trump will blame Paul Ryan, and Hannity will blame Paul Ryan and Evan McMullen, and they'll say the game was rigged, and it'll be harder. The asterisk here, though, is of course that if Trump loses by a landslide, then Republicans probably lose the Senate as well. And there is this really cruel irony, which is that Donald Trump very well could take out people like Congresswoman Barbara Comstock, who's a good conservative Republican who can also get elected in Northern Virginia. And she's the kind of Republican that may be swept out in an anti-Trump year. In fact, Bill, there was a report a few days ago. It's probably now obsolete, but a few days ago of early voting in Virginia, and the early voting report showed that early voting statewide is down 0.4%, but in Northern Virginia, it's up 64%, and that
Yeah, I
really
think
does.
there's something going on with early voting where like I'm in Massachusetts. Massachusetts just canceled early voting this year. It's actually a bit of a misnomer because I've walked in and voted absentee before, which is voting early, but it wasn't defined as early voting with like an actual early voting polling station. I mean, so it's a fine distinction, but now it's being promoted as early voting. People are waiting online to vote early. And I feel like on the left, it's celebratory. It's exciting to vote early. You brag about it. You wear your I voted sticker around town. I was at the farmer's market and people had their I voted stickers and we're talking about it. And on the right, it's still seen as kind of illegitimate. You're violating tradition by not all coming together on election day. This is part of how liberals have rigged the vote and they're shipping in all their people to vote early. And I'm kind of a traditionalist. I kind of like election day voting and having it be all done on one day, but just as a matter of practicality, more days, more bites of the apple, more days to get your
Oh
people
yeah.
out.
No, look,
And
I've voted early like four or five times, and I'm absolutely against early voting. I think it's
well,
horrible, but I do it
it's
out of
kind of like an
convenience.
Uber thing. I mean, you conservatives like touting Uber because there's an element of convenience to it. And ease to it, and when liberals start, nitpicking about rules and regulations and fairness, conservatives say you just want to destroy innovation. You want to go against what the people want. Well, a lot of people want early voting because it's easy, because it's convenient. I can go on the day that I choose. And if only the left is taking advantage of that, that's just giving the left more days to vote than conservatives get. It just seems just like a basic raw. If you're playing a baseball game, one team's playing for 9 innings, the other team's playing for one, you are at a disadvantage.
Yeah, you could say that for sure, for sure. Well, I mean, obviously Democrats have really been capitalizing on this. They've made it an important part of their strategy. But the cruel irony is that, so let's just say that if Barbara Comstock gets swept out in Northern Virginia and Kelly Ayotte gets beat in New Hampshire because of Trump, the irony then is you've got a Republican Party who is sort of down and out and needs reinvention, but people like Barbara Comstock and Kelly Ayotte are gone. And who's left? Who gets to keep their seat? People who live in deep red, districts and states who have completely different incentives. So the people who might help the party reach out to, say, soccer moms in suburban Philadelphia or Northern Virginia, they're gone. They're not in the room anymore. The people who are in the room telling the Republican Party what to do are people who live in safe districts who will say, look, the lesson's simple. If you had just supported Trump, you would have won. I supported Trump. I never wavered at all, and I won re-election. Why didn't you?
But do you
So
think that the future of the party is really coming from? I mean, Barbara Comstock and Kelly Ayotte. I'm not disrespecting them as far as Republicans go. They are, reputable congresspeople. But I don't really see them as being, policy visionaries. So I wouldn't necessarily assume they would be the linchpin to how the Republican Party goes from here. I would think that would come from someone from the outside. I mean, you have we talked about Evan McMullen last week, and since we talked, he was on ABC's This Week with Stephanopoulos, and this didn't get a lot of attention, but he talked about, say, if the Republican Party doesn't change in its posture towards women and minorities, that we might have to start a new party. And if McMullen actually wins Utah and gets those 6 electoral votes and raises his profile and credibility by doing that, is a, I mean, not, I mean, it doesn't have to be him necessarily, but someone like him who has some currency, isn't that person more likely to be a change agent than a backbencher congressperson?
Yes, probably so. And I will say, I think McMullen, he was also on CNBC this week, and I was impressed by him. They were coming after him pretty hard, and he did a great job of pushing back and yet smiling in an authentic, not a fake way, but an authentic way. So he didn't get rattled, but he fought back without getting rattled. I was impressed. No, I think it's a point well taken. Although I think that my point is also valid too, that it does matter to a certain degree what kinds of people. So if you have a Republican Party where the only people in the congressional caucus are people who live in deep red states, that will eventually manifest itself differently in terms of public policy, in terms of the rhetoric that they're talking about, in terms of actual votes that they take in Congress. It's going to make Paul Ryan's, let's just look at, just consider it from Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's standpoint. If the Barbara Comstocks of the world are gone, but the Steve Kings of the world are there, or you get my point, same thing in the Senate. The Ted Cruz's stick around because he's in Texas, and he's not up this time anyway, but you get my point. And the Kelly Ayotte's and the Pat Toomey's lose. That has consequences. And
Oh,
just think of the challenge that presents for McConnell and Ryan and how that might, change things when it comes time to raise the debt ceiling or something like that.
I completely agree with what you're saying. I would go further and say that if the base of the party remains the Trump base, that hamstrings the party in a multitude of ways. And you're already seeing, Jason Chavez, who said he wasn't he didn't endorse Trump. Now he's saying he doesn't endorse him, but he's going to vote for him, and he's saying I'm going to start investigating Hillary on day one. And I've written about this in the past. I've wrote about it again in an ourfuture.org blog post that scandal politics rarely works. Republicans have tried on Bill Clinton, tried on Obama, didn't get him very far. Democrats tried on Bush with Abu Ghraib and Reagan with Iran-Contra, didn't get him very far. It distracts a party from focusing on issues because you think you're going to shortcut your way to power by getting somebody on a scandal.
Everybody wants a silver bullet instead of actually doing the hard work to defeat an opponent or to win the intellectual argument.
Right. And so if
It's a
everyone's
shortcut.
all on the right ginned up on we still can lock her up. We still there's got to be a way. There's something in the emails. There's something which in the State Department, and you just chase that monkey for the next 4 years. You're
And if
just
you
delaying
say,
the
and if you
intellectual
speak out
project.
against that, you're a wimp or a rhino or a cuck conservative or something like that. No, you're right. The last thing I would say, Bill, about the Senate, see, there's so many. It's so weird. There are so many like trends that are going against Republicans right now at so many levels that it's almost just like a perfect storm of badness. And remember, I started writing Too Dumb to Fail in a sense in 2010 when I started writing columns about Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Angle and Sarah Palin, whom I once really liked, sort of became radicalized and went rogue. And so, in other words, I was writing this book before Donald Trump came on the scene as a Republican, which suggests that if Donald Trump leaves, the problem will not necessarily leave with him. But one of the other issues is, will Republicans control the Senate? Charlie Cook has an interesting piece this week at the Cook Report, which, every election day, he looks at the contested Senate seats on election day. And what he's found is that they never break 50-50. So in other words, in 1998, if there were eight contested Senate races, what doesn't happen is Republicans win four and Democrats win four. What actually always happens is one party wins about 75% of the contested Senate seats. So look, 2016 is a weird political year. There's no guarantee that history is going to hold. But if it does, then I think it's I think that the trend suggests that Republicans will lose the Senate if that holds.
I mean, I think that is probably true. I think the Democrats have a far superior ground game operation than Republicans do this year, just by the dint of the fact that Trump's not running one. It's complicating what the RNC does. But I think I mentioned this last week. Let's not forget, 1996, Bill Clinton was leading Dole by double digits, and Republicans pivoted off of Dole and said, "Let's run our candidates as a check to a second Bill Clinton term." Democrats seemingly got complacent. The Clinton Dole margin was significantly smaller than what the polls were saying, although he won handily. But they lost two Senate seats in the process. So, I mean, there's still this wild card out there. How does polling that suggests a preordained outcome affect turnout on both sides? You could argue that could go either way, but you can't totally discount the possibility that Dems say, "Ah, she's got this in the bag. I don't need to show up." And a lot of Republican money has shifted towards the House and the Senate. Maybe they can keep those numbers up and prevent
Did
a
you
full-blown
see
collapse.
the Josh Green Bloomberg piece about
Yeah.
which brought up the suppression that
Yeah.
Republicans are attempting to do? So
Although,
they're
I mean,
attempting.
the Trump quote, there's a Trump aide in that article that says, we have a, I'm not going to quote quite right, but he said, there are three ways we're trying to suppress the vote. I mean, he actually uses the word suppression in the
Why do you
quote.
do that? Why do you tell a journalist about this?
Right. But what he actually says they're going to do isn't really suppression. He's overhyping his own nasty message.
Well, I
I
don't know.
mean,
They're trying to muddy the waters and keep African Americans from voting. Is that suppressing their vote?
well, they're arguing, they're putting rhetorical message into the bloodstream. They're trying to push, hey, remember when Hillary Clinton said super predator? Hey, remember how Hillary enabled Bill Clinton's sexual assault accusers? So that they can use that to depress African American votes and women votes. I mean that which is different than let's take away their polling places so they have to wait in long lines, which is how we normally think of
Well, yeah, I would
suppression.
say he framed it in the most uncharitable way possible toward himself.
Right,
It's
right.
a semantics battle, but normally, if a Republican were doing some sort of an operation like this and the media called it suppression, I would be saying, well, now wait a minute. I don't know if it's suppression. But in this case, the Trump people are actually calling it that themselves. But why do you tell, I just don't get why you tell a journalist that. Like, why do you, like, never, okay, so number one, you shouldn't call it suppression, even if it is. But number two, why do you tell a journalist that you're doing this?
I
Anyway,
mean,
I don't
these are
know.
people who are, in many cases, not professionals, not campaign professionals. They are in a culture, a Trump-led campaign culture, where you say things in the most provocative way possible to make waves, and to make yourself seem strong
So
and
you brag
powerful.
about doing unseemly things, but shouldn't that be
Right.
reserved for just the candidate? Should staffers also have the get to do that? I don't know.
Well,
I guess it's from.
normal political rules is if you're an aide, the number one rule is, don't
Don't be the
make news for
story.
yourself. Get
Yeah.
out of the way and let the boss get the spotlight. But these are people that don't follow, follow normal campaign rules, which actually leads into something else that you wrote this week, right?
Well, I've written so many things, Bill. Help me out here. I'm
Well,
battling
you had a
some
roll
sleep
call about
deprivation.
why journalists
Oh, yeah.
have a bias against Trump that was not the usual, liberal bias argument.
That's right. I think there are three things that aren't obvious. One is that we've trained ourselves to be somewhat pedantic in the way that we write things. You would never, as a writer, say, like, a lot of people are telling me such and such, believe me, you know? And so when we hear him say that, it grates against us. Like, there is a visceral, you know, it's viscerally repellent to us in a way that I don't think it is to a lot of people. So that's one of the things. Another thing is, I think a lot of us who went into political journalism actually love the game of politics and respect and revere it. Like, there's a way to do politics, you know? Like, I've read hundreds of books about about politics, and how the game is played, whether and from both sides. I mean, I've read a ton of books about Reagan, and I read Len Nofziger's book, I read Mike Deaver's book, I've read all the Craig Shirley books, I read Chris Matthews' book Hardball, which is great and underrated. A lot of stuff by Carville and Magala, Bad Boy: The Life and Politics of Lee Atwater by Brady. And a lot of leadership books, Reagan on leadership, Patton on leadership, Attila the Hun on leadership, and books by people like Peter Drucker and John Maxwell and Stephen Covey. And you read all those books and you learn these political maxims. And some of them are about politics, some of them are about leadership, some are about values. But you internalize them, and then Trump comes along and defies all the rules. And as long as he was doing that and winning, I was sort of willing to say, like, well, I guess maybe the rules have changed. But he's not winning anymore. He's not doing the stuff like having a campaign. You're talking earlier about a turnout operation. So I think that a lot of us who went into political journalism have a sort of a deep abiding respect and reverence for the game of politics, or the pro we don't view the process as inherently corrupt. And I think that's the opposite of Trump and his supporters. So that's one of the reasons. I don't remember that. I'm like Rick Perry at this point. I've forgotten the third
Well,
reason, but there is a
I want to
third.
quibble. I want to quibble on that point, though,
All right.
because I mean, I agree with you that Trump doesn't play the game the way professionals think the game should be played, and I agree with you that I'm sure that political pundits, have a reverence for those traditions. But the beginning of this race was the punditocracy in awe of Trump flouting those rules. Wow, the rules don't apply to Trump. Wow, this is amazing. He defies political gravity. This is a true phenomenon that we need to watch carefully. And people were so caught up in that notion that they did not think through that he was only succeeding at cultivating a niche of the political market in a way that anyone that could think two steps ahead would see that wasn't going to translate into a general election. So we're snapping back into talking about how Trump is violating those rules, but that's a byproduct of him losing and clearly losing in the poll. So it's still very poll sensitive. If he was winning, all these same pundits would be writing furious hot takes about how the game has changed and loving writing about that. I mean, that's a fun thing to write about.
All right,
So
so
I.
which brings me to the third point that I had to just look up, but I think it's appropriate because the reason that Trump, the I think when Trump really jumped the shark was with the Access Hollywood thing, and this is where it becomes interesting. So Charles Murray, who is a controversial writer and a like a think tanker at American Enterprise Institute,
He wrote The Bell Curve.
which was that was his really sort of big and controversial book. But he has a more recent book called Coming Apart that argues that working class whites used to be sort of the salt of the earth, people who worked hard and played by the rules. But they have become they're coming apart. And so now they're less likely to say get married, go to church, things like that. Simultaneously, elites, people like you, Bill, elites who, and you actually are a good example of this now that I think about it. So, elites used to be thought of as sort of bohemian, but now they're actually, and their lifestyles, bourgeois. They get married, they have kids, they live decent, good moral lives. They just don't, in Charles Murray's words, preach what they practice. And so this creates a disconnect. Why is it that working class whites are okay with Trump's vulgarity and elites such as yourself are offended by it? And I think not in a phony way to score political points, but actually offended by it in a sincere kind of moral way. And I think that that helps explain this dichotomy, that in a sense, journalists who I think typically classify as elites by this definition, in a way are living more traditional moral lives than working class whites, which might be surprising to some, but if you believe Charles Murray's theory, then that would explain why we are more upset and outraged by Donald Trump's vulgarity than some of my relatives, you know?
Well, I don't think people in the media or on the left are upset at Trump for being vulgar.
I do.
They're upset that they think he's being racist and misogynistic. It's not that he uses bad language or that he's been married 3 times. I mean, I don't think people in the media or on the left or in the bourgeois upper class in general get upset by that sort of thing. You know, there's an ad in a contested race in New Jersey. This is Northern New Jersey, and the congressman, the incumbent, is Scott Garrett, who's very conservative. And he has won in Northern New Jersey because it's a hybrid district that's actually part rural social conservative and Wall Street suburban Republican. So for the last several years, those two camps have been on the same team, the same conservative team. But now that Wall Street side is chafing at the social conservatism. And is starting to break away. So the Democrat in the race, his last name has escaped me right now, I apologize. But he has an ad up this week, a TV ad, that is titled Sweet Old Lady. And it's a grandma on a park bench, and she's ticking off everything she's read in the newspaper about Scott Garrett. And she's dropping F-bombs. As she reacts to it, they're bleeped, but you clearly know what they are. And so he's talking about being opposed to gays running for office, and she's saying, you know, can you blank believe that? And at the end of the ad, she turns to her grandson and says, "Oh, come on, sweetie, it's time to come home." So it's meant to be cute and funny, but it's a very close race, and so it's a bit of a gutsy ad to play because, you know, some people might be offended by that kind of language in a TV ad, but it's New Jersey, it's Northern New Jersey, and people's cultural sensibilities are a bit more open to, you know, basic bad language, even
now, Bill,
in, you know, upper echelons.
Bill, we can either sit here and you can poke holes at all my theories, or you can jump on board and we can agree that this was a brilliant column. Which is it going to be? I mean, how's it going to be? Hard or easy today?
Well, I'm not saying it's not a brilliant column. I would modify it in certain ways if I was the one writing it. I mean, there's definitely a cultural disconnect between the media elites and what Trump is doing. But I don't think you can separate that from race and gender. I mean, I think...
Okay, but I would say that when Trump says... grabbing a woman, that isn't just a politically incorrect social justice warrior thing that only liberals would be offended by. I would say that that is a thing that devout Christians or any really people of faith from a moral standpoint would also be offended by. But why is it that I'm offended by it from a sort of moral standpoint, but some of my working class white relatives, well, they might not like it, but they're more than willing to overlook it.
Well, I was to go back to Evan McMullen, my favorite conservative at this point. I was struck by the fact
you said something there that bothered me. I want to stop you. Evan McMullen's you said Evan McMullen's your favorite conservative at this point.
My favorite conservative politician.
Okay.
Now my favorite conservative intellectual, Matt. You know, no one can replace you. I'll never quit you.
All right. Because he's going to need something to do in 2 weeks, and I don't want him canceling my show. And we're on a, you know, what if Blogging Hits has like on an all new DMZ? You know, Bill Scherer, Evan McMullen. Ratings will be through the roof.
The fact that he criticized Trump and the current Republican Party on their treatment of women and minorities, I mean, it was sounding like it had a liberal sound to it. You know, he wasn't finding a way to talk about it in a traditional conservative way. He was more making a generational point that, hey, the younger conservatives just don't think this way. That's not how we deal with women, not how we deal with race. And you got to get
that's true, but isn't that also compassionate conservatism? I mean, George W. Bush said family values don't stop at the Rio Grande. I mean, this is also a throwback to that, right?
There's definite overlap there, absolutely. But I the language that he used, I thought, had a liberal sheen to it that I'm not used to. And this is a guy who I would, for all I can tell, is no moderate. I just think that he is grasping that people his age and younger are, you know, not, you know, there's a time, I think, where conservatives would be instinctually alienated and angered by any kind of, you know, quote unquote identity politics type rhetoric. If you're talking about women and minorities as separate categories in and of itself, like you've already been too politically correct for my taste. And McMullen wasn't doing that. McMullen was eagerly talking about the need for sensitivity when communicating about, you know, issues that pertain to those communities. That's where I think, you know, Trump is reveling in being politically incorrect. I mean, there's this whole politically incorrect narrative that has, you know, been the pulse of conservatism for a very long time. McMullen might be a signal that that is changing with younger conservatives.
Well, I think there's a huge fight over that. I mean, there are other young conservatives who are, well, conservatives, I use the term loosely, but the alt-right. Did you see that New Yorker piece?
Yeah, the other day? The New Yorker piece, but I'm thwarted by the New Yorker paywall right now. But I'm
aware have to tell me how to get
there
around
are young
the
alt-righters who are not very sensitive when it comes to women minorities.
Yes, there's. I'm not sure which direction the youths of America are on the right are going. If Evan McMullen's going to win that battle, because there's another group of young conservatives, again using the term loosely, who seem to be going in a dramatically different and this New Yorker piece. I know you're thwarted by the paywall, but this New Yorker piece, it talked about it was focused on this one guy who started off as like in the pickup artist movement. Do you know about this, Bill?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I know you've read all their books and seen their videos in your younger days. But for those who are not familiar, the pickup artists, they teach guys how to like manipulate women and pick up women. And they are part of the alt-right. Like that's with the gamers and the men's rights movement and the white nationalists. Like, and that's where this guy comes from. It's a whole worldview. And frankly, it's pretty consistent with the way Donald Trump acts, you know?
Well, I know we want to wrap up soon, but I do want to talk about something that I did to get my own self-promotion out of the way before we go. So I had a piece.
It's always about you, Bill. Always about you.
So I had a piece up in Real Clear Politics on Monday, why the WikiLeaks attack fizzled. So you have this, everyone was, you know, Roger Stone, your favorite conservative fashion plate, you know, tweeted at the top of October.
He's the fashion editor of the Daily Caller.
That's right. He tweeted on a Monday, the first Monday of October, you know, on Wednesday, Hillary Clinton is done, hashtag WikiLeaks. And then nothing happened on Wednesday. The Podesta dump came on Friday, presumably what Stone was referring to. And Hillary's numbers have only gone up since then, not by a lot. She was already leading. But there's no downward track after weeks of us pouring through Podesta's emails. And there's certainly lots of embarrassing things in there. There's things that I'm sure she would rather have not been made public. We've seen some of the Wall Street transcripts. We've seen Clinton aides say sarcastic and condescending things about Sanders supporters and the left in general. We've seen the inner workings of how they've had to beat back negative media narratives. But this has not altered her trajectory in the polls at all. So So you have to, I think you have to analyze why that is. And the most obvious reason is the Podesta email dump came on the same day as the Access Hollywood hot mic moment. In fact, it came out a few minutes after that was released, which Podesta himself suggested was WikiLeaks trying to divert attention away from Access Hollywood and failing miserably at it. So you could say, well, if you know this wasn't Donald Trump and this hot mic moment didn't happen, maybe this would have been a bigger deal for Hillary. And maybe so. That could totally be possible. If Trump was running a very smooth and gaffe-free campaign and it was a three-point race and all the attention was on this for 3 weeks, maybe we'd be talking about a very different campaign. But we're not in that universe. We're in this universe. And the analysis of most of the Podesta emails has been not that much here. I kind of suspected this already. Yeah, this is kind of embarrassing. This is kind of raw, but this is what a lot of politics is. And because of that, I argue, our threshold of what constitutes a successful act of cyber war, of cyber hacking, is altered. The next time there's a drop like this on some other politician, if it is similarly embarrassing but not exactly scandalous, are we all going to say, you know, that's what the Podesta emails were like? That's the way politicians and their staff talk. That's just how it works. Maybe someone gets fired. You know, some guy at the DNC got fired after the DNC leak came out. That sucks for that guy, but it didn't alter the institutions of democracy. It didn't change the outcome of the election. So if all you're doing is embarrassing individuals and feeding the gossip mill on the Washington cocktail party circuit, are you really successfully waging cyber war? So I think, and if Russia's strategy here, I mean, the working assumption of the U.S. Intelligence Committee is Russia is feeding this stuff to WikiLeaks.
Wait a second, Bill. I don't know that we know that. We don't know that that's not China.
Well, even if it was China, someone is doing it to undermine people's perceptions of the integrity of American democracy. Probably it's more likely that than actually trying to elect Trump. But it is in Russia's interest for America to be seen as equivalently corrupt as Russia. So America does not have any kind of moral authority over them in the battle of ideas on the global stage. But if that's not how Americans respond to it, or the world at large for that matter, then the attack didn't work.
Yeah, it's sort of like future attacks won't work. If you just mute trolls on the internet, on Twitter, you're not feeding the trolls. You know, if we don't take the bait, then they lose some power.
I mean, this is a keep calm and carry on kind of reaction I think we're getting from Americans, which some people say we should have that in the case of actual, you know, fatal terrorism. That obviously you shouldn't mourn victims, but people shouldn't go into a panic and then make decisions in haste that make the problem worse. You want to keep a stiff upper lip and stick to your foreign policy and your national security strategy. No one's lives are being lost in these cyber acts, so it's easier to do that. But we do seem to be doing that. And
I think the obvious question, though, is I think your theory is that because this time it hasn't been a big deal, that Americans will get used to this, and that it probably means that the next time, if there's not a huge scandal, in other words, if there were a similar release 2 years from now or 4 years from now, because of this time, it would also be greeted with a yawn. But I don't know.
You had a real smoking gun. I mean, there's something actually provably scandalous.
Right.
Yeah, it'd be a different,
But what if there's not a Donald Trump running next time, and the media is desperate for stories? Wouldn't that lower the bar of what constitutes as scandalous?
Well, you'd have the story. I mean, there's no way. You know, there was a piece in Vox, I think it was by Zach Bouchamp, saying the devious genius of the Russian strategy is that's weaponizing the press against itself and ourselves. It's discrediting the press because there's all this narrative about how, journalists colluding with the Clinton campaign because, God forbid, they got on a conference call or checked a quote with somebody. And so because the media can't help themselves to report on it, even though it's stolen property, that's what they live for. They live for getting an unsolicited leak to pay stories on. So they have to do it. And I'm
But
sure it
doesn't
happens
it
in the
seem?
future.
But I feel like a lot of what the media makes into a scandal. There's a lot of relativism or so. Like for example, Chris Christie shut down a lane of a bridge, arguably, and that turned into a huge scandal. But there's stuff recently. We know there are possible quid pro quo with Hillary Clinton's. Somebody from the State Department talking to somebody from the FBI. There's another story about how close Clinton confidant Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, made a large contribution to a political candidate whose husband became the deputy director of the FBI, who was investigating the scandals. So, couldn't, like, in a different media environment, and maybe if Hillary Clinton was a Republican, couldn't those stories have become a much bigger deal than they did become?
I mean, again, I think they would have been if Trump wasn't in the way. I agree with that. But because he was in the way, the coverage of those stories were more nuanced. I mean, you heard the stories, you also heard the counter narratives to those stories. Well, both FBI and state say that one email doesn't capture everything that happened here. There was some misunderstanding. There was an allegation of quid pro quo, but it really wasn't. And here's what really happened. In the Terry McAuliffe case, there's people saying, well, of course he made that he made that campaign donation. He was trying to win Senate control, state legislative control for the Democrats. So it was a logical payment to make. There's no obvious reason to presume he was trying to rig some future investigation of the FBI into Clinton. So it's possible that in the future, that when these sorts of things happen, there's going to be maybe a breath taken by the press and said, okay, we've been down this path before. We know that an email might be a thread to pull, but it also might be lacking a lot of context. So before I go nuts here, I'm going to go get that context. And if the context is that it's still bad, then yeah, if you find a scandal, you find a scandal. But there was a threat here that without proof of a scandal, these things would be damaging in and of itself, and I think that's not what's happening right now.
I mean, it might be like how in the future everybody who runs for president is going to have had a Facebook page and a blog and a podcast. And so, like, there's going to be people who get burned initially, but eventually it's going to be like, well, everyone put up naked pictures in high school and on Facebook. You know what I mean? And so maybe like everybody at some point, everybody will have lived their whole lives on email, and so revelations that come out of email won't be as scandalous as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I
It's
don't want to go too
possible.
much longer, as I know we both have to wrap things up. But I'm very struck by this photo of Florida Democratic Senate candidate Patrick Murphy, which Rubio's people have spread around as evidence that he groped a woman when he was younger. And his arms around the woman and his hands like a little bit on her breast, and they blur her face out. But it's clearly a posed picture, where he's not like caught in the act of doing something nasty. He's posing with a picture with a smile on his face, and his team says, "Yeah, he was posing with a picture with his girlfriend. That's not a scandalous picture." But when you blur out her face, it makes it look like you're hiding something that's awful. And I'm just not in Florida. I'm not talking to anybody there, so I can't tell how the average Florida voter is reacting to it. And he was already a little bit behind Rubio anyway, but it's still kind of a close race. But I'm curious if Florida voters are saying that's just a regular photo. That's not groping. I don't know what if I know you follow
Well, it
Rubio
fit, yeah, I
more
mean,
closely. If
it
you're
fits into
different
this
vibe from people.
conversation that everyone like is going to have a record of them when they were 18 or 22 on Facebook doing stupid stuff, you know? And eventually, after enough people, there are enough, like, okay, so like Gary Hart gets burned in 1988, in 1992, Bill Clinton doesn't. And I'm sure there are many extenuating circumstances and variables, but one of the variables I suspect is that the public became inured and desensitized to sex scandals in that time. And so I think it's reasonable to suspect that leaked emails and leaked pictures from our wilder days. I'm sure if you were to go digging around, what's the college that Lena Dunham went to, Bill?
My college, Oberlin.
If you were to go digging around at Oberlin, talking to people, looking at pictures, there could be some interesting stuff that comes up about Bill Scheer. But, Shepherd College, West Virginia, Shepherdstown, West Virginia, possibly. It's unclear what may or may not exist out there, incriminating information. But hopefully, by the time you run for president with on the Evan McMullen Bill Scheer ticket,
You need ticket.
the public will be totally desensitized to this stuff.
Well, why don't we leave it on that cliffhanger of a note?
All
Anything else
right.
you got to plug before we go?
Just check out the podcast, Matt Lewis and the News. Check out this podcast, The DMZ Show. Follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. And read Bill's Real Clear Politics piece. And I think that's it.
That's it.
All right. See you guys. Let me see. We're taping this on Thursday. We only have one more show before the election, is that right?
That's right. So next week is the
Wow.
prediction show.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to bring our A game next week.
And
Okay.
I think by next week, Matt, you have an obligation to tell everybody who you're voting for or if you are voting at all.
I will tell them, but as of now, I've been where I've been for 6 months. I'm calling it passive resistance. I will not be voting. And you know how people like show those pictures with the little pen or the little sticker, I voted? I'm going to be sitting doing pictures of me all day not voting. Because I'm very proud of this passive resistance. I
Well,
don't like to use the word
are you
hero
in
to
Barbara
describe me.
Comstock's district?
No, I would vote if I was in her district. But see, there's no down ballot repercussions. She could not live, she could not survive in my district. And see, she wouldn't have made it this far in my district.
I
I'm
can't
in
believe
a.
you're not feeling the McMullen momentum, though.
If I lived in, maybe if I lived in Utah, but I don't think he's got a shot in Virginia anyway. So.
All right,
And he
till next week.
has not, I would just say, from for a strictly selfish standpoint, he has not come on the Matt Lewis and News podcast. So.
There's a vote buying scandal here in the works.
What would it be wrong, like if I promised to vote for him if he came on? Would that be considered an
Media
illegal
collusion. You're
overture?
colluding right here, right now.
So you're saying if my emails were leaked and that came out, okay. Well, luckily it didn't happen, but I'll be careful what I put in writing from now on. All right.
Till next week.
See, you got it. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.